The viewpoints expressed on Night Fright are not necessarily those of the host, the staff, the sponsors, or the affiliate stations. Tonight's program may contain graphic themes or images. Viewer discretion is advised.
Welcome to the show. I'm Brent Holland. Welcome, one and all, to Night Fright. Get the coffee going. Get the tea going. Get a beverage of your choice going. We've got a good show for you tonight. It is the beginning of our JFK special. Again, it is November, folks, already. How does that happen once a year? And I'm going to be talking about a brand new book by an author you may have heard of. The book is called JFK Assassination, From the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza. And the author, as I point to it right here, is me. In truth, folks, I had a guest lined up for tonight. Family illness, and he had to cancel last second. And I couldn't get a guest to fill in the past 5 hours. I've been trying, but unable to. So I thought, you know, given it's November, and it is the beginning of our JFK special annual, you know, it's November 22nd, 1963, all those years ago is when President Kennedy was assassinated. As usual, Night Fright nobody covers the Kennedy assassination, the Bobby Kennedy assassination, or the Martin Luther King assassination, or the Malcolm X assassination, for that matter, better than Night Fright. I'm very proud of that, because when I started the show, it was started as a paranormal conspiracy show. Fans of this show, deep fans of this show, will know that I just don't stay on the paranormal. I cover everything from terrorism to people like Jane Goodall, Ted Sorensen. So Night Fright Show shouldn't be pigeonholed as a paranormal conspiracy show. It's anything that scares you in the middle of the night. And the whole show's idea from the beginning was to inspire people to achieve more than they ever thought possible. And that's why I try to get some of the best researchers and guests on, because there's something out there. We all know that. And let's take alien abduction. Fans of this show will know when I cover alien abductions, everybody starts to laugh that are listening, tuning in right now for a JFK show. Wait a second, guys. If this is a real phenomena for so many people, even if it is a mental illness, should we be ostracizing those people and ridiculing them and laughing at them? I don't think so. I think if people are suffering anywhere, whatever the cause, it needs to be researched, and it needs to be dived into, and it needs to be resolved so people don't suffer. And that's why I cover alien abductions and everything else that goes along with it. Bigfoot, yeah, I get a lot of hits. Oh, Bigfoot, JFK can't be associated with Bigfoot. Well, guess what, folks? If you do a little research on the Night Fright Show, you are going to find a woman by the name of Jane Goodall. Jane Goodall told me square in an interview she believes in Bigfoot. Find out the reasons why. There's mysteries everywhere. Don't close your mind to anything. Everything is possible. And JFK taught us that without question. So tonight I'm going to start off with my book. What makes this book different than all the other books of research information? This fella right here I'm pointing to, Ted Sorensen. No other book of this genre has Ted Sorensen in it. And I was able to interview Ted once by radio, and the other time I spent an afternoon with him in his Manhattan apartment. And, you know, I was in Manhattan, here's another example of Night Fright Show, to interview three Nobel Peace laureates. See, folks, not just Bigfoot shows and or anything else, three Nobel Peace laureates. And I called up a young lady by the name of Lori, I won't give her last name on air, to see if I could interview Ted and go down and meet and greet with him. And I expected her to say no. She said, let me call you back. And every 15 minutes she had called me back. She said, be at Ted's Manhattan apartment tomorrow at 4. Oh, my God. I didn't sleep a wink that night. And I'm not kidding. I mean, this is Ted Sorensen. This is the guy that saved the world with his letter to Khrushchev. And if you're unaware of that story, you got to get my book, because it was not JFK. It was JFK designated that particular letter to get Khrushchev to back down to Ted Sorensen. And Ted walks us through every second of that night. And how close did we come? Let me give you a good example of how close we came. We were so close to nuclear annihilation that President Kennedy had called his wife to bring the kids home to the White House where they could all die the next day. Now, let's fast forward now for those that are younger now that don't remember President Kennedy. They simply weren't alive. They were probably born in this century or even, you know, the 1990s. What would that mean? Well, imagine yourself today if things in the Ukraine or things in Syria escalate. And the United States is up against its old adversary, Russia. And Russia decides that they're going to put their nuclear missiles on alert. And they have already done this in the Ukraine, by the way. Russia had put their whole nuclear forces on alert. And all of a sudden, there's a standoff. And the president calls his wife to bring the two girls home, because that's how close we were going to come to a nuclear war. Imagine that today. What would you do? Where would you go? There's nothing to do. There's nowhere to go. That's how close we were, October 1962. That's why I was so, so honored to interview Ted Sorensen, virtually the man that saved the world. And by the way, folks, his complete and final interview, because he passed away just several weeks after I interviewed him, is in this book. And he unloads, people. He unloads about the assassination. He unloads about the possibilities of a military coup. Oh, yeah, this is from Ted Sorensen, folks. This is in the third person reading the archives and making assumptions and giving their own input. This is directly from the closest source to the president that we have alive, that we had alive today. In any research, as everybody knows that's done a research paper, the closer you are to the original source, the more accurate your paper is going to be. You're not going to get any closer than Ted Sorensen, and he tells all that story. The book is called JFK Assassination from the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza. What I've done is I've put first-person witnesses' testimonies in this, people I've interviewed, people like Dr. Robert McClelland. Dr. Robert McClelland was the doctor who worked on JFK. And Dr. Robert McClelland tells us in the book that he saw the back of JFK's head blasted out, the lower right quadrant, and I'm pointing on camera, but you can imagine the lower right quadrant. What that means is a frontal shot. What a frontal shot means is at least two shooters. What two shooters means is conspiracy, folks. And that, in a nutshell, is exactly where we're at right now with this book. So let me continue, and I'm going to read on a little bit and see if... let me just open up the book here. I'm going to give you a great example of what I'm talking about. And this is Abraham Bolden. Abraham Bolden was the first African-American Secret Service agent handpicked by JFK. And his story is amazing. He was not on duty November 26, 1963. 22nd, 1963, but he was supposed to be protecting the president prior to that. In order to sell that Bill of Rights of Good to the American people, they came out with the cover-up, and they covered up everything that would probably point in another direction. They did that in hopes that the American people would buy that thing they were selling, called the truth. But it was absolutely falsehood. This is from Abraham Bolden's original quote, folks. That's what I'm talking about. In this book, you're going to get as close to the original source as possible, because it is the original source. You don't have to go through a third party's interpretation. You can make your own decision, and that's what Night Fright's about as well, giving you the information to make an educated decision for yourself. I don't treat you like imbeciles, and I don't treat you like infants on this show, because you're not. We cannot stand up when things affect us alone. We have to stand up wherever we find corruption in a democratic process. That's our obligation to the American people, our obligation to our children, and it's our obligation to God to be the best people that we can be while we're on this planet Earth. It's Abraham Bolden. Heroes come. This is from the book, by the way, folks. Heroes come in many forms. Sports heroes are fine in their own right, but Mr. Bolden is a true American hero. I've always been drawn toward men of fortitude, honor, and integrity. Abraham Bolden is just such a man. Abraham Bolden was the first African-American Secret Service agent to be placed on White House detail. He was handpicked by President Kennedy himself to guard the president's own family. Abraham was not on duty that fateful day in Dallas, and that haunts him to this very day, folks. He fully believes, as I do, that had he only been there somehow, some way, he would have been president. He would have kept President Kennedy alive, even if that meant taking the fatal bullet himself. Mr. Bolden was subsequently set up by his fellow Secret Service agents to silence his whistleblowing, damning accusations about drunk Secret Service agents that day in Dallas, accusations that were validated shortly thereafter. Their blatant racism, drunkenness, and womanizing while on duty left them unable to protect President Kennedy. Now, in order to silence Mr. Bolden and protect their own careers and reputations, the Secret Service agents had to deflect the accusations, because they were true, folks. Mr. Bolden was subsequently set up and charged by the very Secret Service that he was part of with soliciting a $50,000 bribe to pass along a file containing incriminating evidence in a counterfeit scheme. The charges were blatantly false and were levied in an obvious attempt to silence Mr. Bolden. He went through an American justice system that can only be described as a third world court. That is, guilty as charged. It's not the American justice system. Regardless of the absence of evidence or witnesses to substantiate the charge. And Mr. Bolden was guilty as charged even before the trial began. It was just absolutely embarrassing for the American government to have done this to this man. The prosecution's main witness, are you ready for this? Joseph Spagnoli. This was the prosecution's main witness. This witness, Joseph Spagnoli, claimed that Mr. Bolden had given him $50,000, whom Mr. Bolden had previously arrested, was a career criminal. He later admitted under oath that his testimony incriminating Mr. Bolden was 100% fabricated. Let me read that again. He later admitted under oath that his testimony incriminating Mr. Bolden was 100% fabricated. Alarmingly, Spagnoli testified that he was forced to say these statements against Mr. Bolden under duress and threats from, guess who? Secret Service. So once again, the Secret Service forced him to tell lies, Joseph Spagnoli, in order to make sure Mr. Bolden was going to be found guilty. Yet Mr. Bolden was still incarcerated, and no investigation at all into Spagnoli's perjured statements or into the Secret Service were ever made. Such was the blatant and desperate attempt to keep Mr. Bolden silent. That was, after all, 1960s America, where African Americans were no strangers to a biased justice system. Let's face it, folks, 1960s. This was the time in history that you read about, when whites who had murdered blacks were found not guilty, and they were released on almost a weekly basis. Blacks, essentially, folks, had no chance in such a justice system. They presumed that Abraham, a Negro, once locked away behind bars, would simply slip into the night out of sight, out of mind. But they had no idea who they were dealing with. And that, folks, is a little bit from the book JFK Assassination, From the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza. For the rest of that story and the heroic things that Mr. Bolden did and the endurance that he showed is absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning. This is what you're going to get in this book, folks. First-person witness accounts. And he goes on and he tells his story in his own words, and you've got that right here. This book, folks, is an historical document. That's what I designed it for. Not to make a pile of money, because I haven't made any money off of it yet. As a matter of fact, I'm still in the hole, almost $2,500. I made the book for not only our generation, but the next generation. We've already seen the loss of Ted Sorensen. He's gone. This is his final, final testament in this book. This is historic. We, you know, all these witnesses that I've got in this book, folks, are well into their 80s. They're not going to live forever. And the only evidence we're going to have is their own oral history and testimony to what they actually saw. That's why I wrote the book. This is an historic document for all researchers in the future. 100 years, 200 years from now. You know, when we look back in history, we always look to the Bible, because that's basically one of our most accurate sources for biblical times, because there's just nothing else written down. That's why I wrote this book, so you would have their first-person testimonies, so you could make your own decisions based on what they said. Let's pick another one, shall we? Because there's lots of them in this book. Let's go right here, and here's another interview with a fella who's also passed away. And this is one of his last interviews. James Tague, the man responsible, inadvertently, for the magic bullet. Let me read why. James Tague, the man responsible for the magic bullet. It's time the American people knew the truth. I'm probably, and I hope I'm not boasting, but I'm probably the only person as close to everything that was going on as anybody. And that's being there in Dealey Plaza. Testimony in front of the Warren Commission. As a matter of fact, nobody knows this, folks. This is very well hidden by the powers that be. As a matter of fact, they had to redo the whole Warren Commission after my testimony. That's right, folks. There was two Warren Commissions. The first one had to be scrapped because James Tague came forward. And I'll read on. The Warren Commission was assembled by the American government in 1964 to investigate the Kennedy assassination. It was about to release its findings to the press. The Warren Commission was about to say that there were three empty bullet shells found in the sniper's nest on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, where they believed the purported assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, had fired all three shots. Therefore, the three bullets, turning the page, it's radio, baby, what can we do? You know, some of you are watching on TV, but for those on radio, that's what that little thing was saying. flipping pages. Three shots and three wounds were all originating from above and behind the president, all fired by a single assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, according to the Warren Commission's first report, remember I just said there's two. This is the first one that was scrapped. The first shot hit Kennedy in the back between the shoulder blades. Now, as Kennedy fell to the side, we all see this in the Zapruder film, he exposed Governor Connally, who was sitting in the limousine's jump seat directly in front of the president. Now, the second shot, according to the first Warren Commission report, hit Connally from the back, causing five wounds in the governor. So already that's questionable, because this bullet, folks, broke his rib and it broke his wrist. And any hunter will tell you, if you shoot a carcass in the rib, the bullet is going to be mushroomed. It's going to be distorted. Well, of course, we know, and I'll read on, that the magic bullet, as this bullet is called, is never distorted. But that should have been an alarm flag right there. And this is only the first report. The third and final shot hit President Kennedy in the back of the head, killing him. Now, here's the problem with that. As I just said before, Parkland Hospital doctor Robert McClelland and virtually everybody who worked on Dr. McClelland on President Kennedy that day virtually saw the back of President Kennedy's head blown out. So somebody please tell me how a bullet enters from the back of somebody's skull and then does a U-turn only to come right back out and blast the back of the head out. Yeah, so it's like we got a Cirque du Soleil bullet as well as a magic bullet. It would be a nice, neat, tidy package, except for a fellow by the name of James Taig, who was also in Dealey Plaza during the assassination. Taig courageously stepped forward to ask where the president's fourth wound came from. Now, the Warren Commission had a major problem, baby. How could they possibly explain only three empty shell casings and only three bullets from Oswald's gun, yet now, not three, but four wounds? The Warren Commission virtually went back to the drawing table to do this sucker, because they had a draw, and came up with what we now know as the magic bullet theory. The commission decided that there was still only three bullets, four wounds with three bullets. But suddenly, the bullets had now miraculously caused four wounds. The first bullet had not hit Kennedy at all. No, never hit JFK. Now, the second Warren Commission now, right? Now, instead, it had now missed President Kennedy's limousine completely, hit a curb where it ricocheted and hit James Taig standing by the triple underpass, who was watching the motorcade. How do we know this? Because a police officer by the name of Harkins saw the blood spatter on his cheek. Taig was a little bit in shock, so we know he was wounded as well. The second shot now hit Kennedy in the back between the shoulder blades, just off center to the right, around 4 inches below the neck. Warren Commission member Gerald Ford, who would later become President Ford, decided that in order to have the evidence coincide with the magic bullet theory, he would change the location of the wound from Kennedy's back up to his neck in the report, even though the shot was really located below JFK's neck between his shoulder blades. That's right, folks. Gerald Ford reported in the Warren Commission report, because he was part of it, he was just a young guy in those days, that the bullet hole really did, even though all the autopsy photos and everything else and the witnesses said that the bullet entered JFK's back between the shoulder blades, he decided in the report that he was going to move that wound up to the back of JFK's neck. Because don't forget, they want this bullet to be able to exit JFK's neck in the front. Everybody knows that the angle it enters in JFK's back from the Texas School Book Depository, if that's where it came from, and we're assuming that, would come out his chest because of the angle. it would not in any sense ever come out of his neck. I'll read on. The bullet entered Kennedy's back and then rose upward in Kennedy's body, according to Gerald Ford, to exit Kennedy's throat. It then went through Connolly, breaking Connolly's wrist, finally lodging itself in Connolly's leg. Miraculously, this bullet caused 7 wounds in both JFK and Connolly. Now it gets better, folks. It gets even better for this Cirque du Soleil bullet, as I call it, the magic bullet. The bullet was found lying on a gurney at Parkland Hospital. Isn't that convenient? Geez, we're looking for this bullet. Where can... Oh, look on that gurney right over there. There's the bullet. It was not bent out of shape, as bullets that break bones are. Instead, it was found in almost pristine condition, as if it had been fired into cotton or water. Sounds like a little bit like a plant. But I'll let you draw your own conclusions. On top of this, and this is the best part of all of it, this bullet, there was no blood or tissue found on the magic bullet. Let me repeat that. On top of all of this, there was no blood or tissue found on the magic bullet. Now, this is the bullet, they say, caused 7 wounds, broke 2 bones. No blood, no tissue, pristine condition. Cirque du Soleil bullet. There are more bullet fragments actually inside Governor Connolly's wounds than are missing from the single bullet that they claim made all of the wounds, which is impossible. Now you know why it's called the magic bullet. The third and last bullet apparently hit Kennedy in the back of the head, where, instead of exiting from the front of the head, it did an abrupt U-turn in Kennedy's head and instead blew the back of his head out and caused Kennedy to be thrown backward, not forward, and to the left. James Tague was present in Dealey Plaza that fateful day. He stood unassumingly near the triple underpass watching the motorcade come towards him. He had no idea that in the next few seconds his life would become intrinsically entwined with the JFK assassination, and he would become the person inadvertently responsible for the magic bullet theory. What's more, along with the president and Governor Connolly, Tague was also wounded by a sniper's bullet, making him the third victim in the shooting spree that took place that day. That very wound to James Tague has carried reverberations felt to this very day. What follows is the true, courageous story of a Dealey Plaza first-person witness, James Tague. This is the story of a 27-year-old man whose beliefs and innocences were shattered that day in Dealey Plaza. And then James goes on and he tells his whole story in his own words. First-person witness, all his testimony in his own words. What he witnessed during the motorcade, what he witnessed during the assassination, what happened after the assassination when he was struck with that bullet, when he came forward and the Warren Commission tried to denounce his testimony and make him look like a fool, how they tried to cover up the ricochet on the curb, all that in his own words. First-person witness, as close to the source as you can possibly get, because James Tague is the source. That's the beauty of this book, JFK Assassination, from the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza. Now, why did I call it the Oval Office, from the Oval Office? Because, as I mentioned before, Ted Sorensen, this fellow right here on the front cover of the book, JFK's closest aide and speechwriter, it's his last and final interview, and he unloads the possibilities of a coup from the military. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, they were worried about that, big time worried about that, and maybe that carried over. He also gives a hint, if you will, but an educated hint, because he's as close to it as you can get, to who was really behind the assassination. What sources were brewing behind the assassination? He unloaded, folks. I'm not kidding. He also confirms, in my mind, conspiracy. And he confirmed that in a video, which I have, on March, I think it was 23rd, 2010. And he passed away in October 2010. So, folks, this is the real deal. And as I said before, what makes this book different than all the others? Ted Sorensen. Nobody else has that source as close to JFK as Ted Sorensen. Let me read something from Ted Sorensen. In his own words, by the way, folks, which is absolutely amazing. Okay, here we go. I'm going to give you a little bit of a tantalizing hint here. Because I want to read you what he said about the possibilities, the very real possibilities of a military coup. Fear of a military coup in the United States. Ted Sorensen's own words. This is the interview I had with him. Here we go. Holland. Sir, you had alluded to a fear that perhaps the Hawks could take over in this. I'm talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And this will be my final question for the Cuban Missile Crisis. Was there a real threat of that fear running through the administration and perhaps a coup could take place in the United States? Now, his answer shocked me because I was expecting him to denounce that question and maybe even get a little mad at me for even daring to ask a question like that under President Kennedy's administration. Here's what he answered. Sorensen, there had been, at that very same period, a very good movie called 7 Days in May, directed by John Frankenheimer, starring Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. That's my own little, just to give you a reference. So you can find it on YouTube. You can find it just about anywhere. It's a classic movie about a military coup in the United States, which was total fiction about a U.S. Army takeover of the White House based on a really good book. It was a good movie, too, and we used to joke about the movie, whether it could actually happen here. Very ominous. It was no joke, and this is the part that stunned me and gives me chills to this day, when the Joint Chiefs, before that first week was over, demanded a session with Kennedy. Because unlike the more recent movie, 13 Days, they did not attend our daily nightly XCOM meetings, except for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Maxwell Taylor, who was not a wild man like some of the chiefs were. He was, on the contrary, very scholarly, reasonable. Holland, and handpicked by Kennedy, wasn't he? General Maxwell Taylor, folks. I give you a little bit of background when he mentions a character or somebody mentions a character, because I want to keep you in context with what's going on and who these people are and what they meant to Kennedy and the administration and what they meant to history. General Maxwell Taylor, brief bio, was an accomplished 4-star general with a solid background in diplomacy. He had commanded the famed 101st Airborne in World War II, parachuted with his men into Normandy on D-Day. He's a ballsy guy, you know. He certainly probably didn't have to do that to go in with his men, especially being a general, and was the first general on the ground in Normandy. Taylor, like Kennedy during the Eisenhower administration in the 50s, thought that Eisenhower's heavy reliance on nuclear weapons for the defense of the United States left far too few options to be used in case of war. Kennedy liked options. He didn't want to always have to turn to a nuclear deterrent in order to stave off war. He wanted to be, that's why he started Special Forces, and I'll get there in a second. Taylor, also like JFK, feared that any conflict, no matter how minor, would quickly escalate into a nuclear holocaust. Now, as a consequence of his thinking on nuclear weapons and the need for a wider range of conventional options, he was JFK's first choice for the Joint Chief of Staff when JFK fired General Lyman Lewis Limnitzer for his role in the Bay of Pigs, because that was the old Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he was the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Bay of Pigs, and they were trying to really manipulate JFK into going into Cuba at that time. JFK was very nervous that it might start a war. And by the way, Ted covers that very aspect and gives the reasons why Kennedy never sent that air support that he gets blamed for all the time. It wasn't Kennedy's fault. Not at all. Not at all. And if you want to hear the true story, it's in the book. And that true story all leads up to the assassination. Why was Kennedy killed? I continue. It is worth noting, however, that it was JFK who created the Green Berets and the use of special forces to carry out stealthy, essential military options. The special forces would later branch out to the SEALs, Delta, etc. It's also worth noting that not only was Taylor handpicked by Kennedy, but he and Bobby Kennedy became such close friends that Bobby named one of his children after him. So it seems that he's a pretty good guy. And, you know, Kennedy brought him in to keep an eye on the other joint chiefs that were kind of hawkish, wild. You get the drift. Shoot first, ask later, that type of thing. Which was probably a leftover plan from the Second World War, because don't forget, all these guys had gone through the Second World War and appeasement. They didn't want to appease anything. We're now living in a nuclear age where one nuclear bomb is going to make for a very, very, very bad day. So you've got to avoid and deal with conflict in a different way, in a different manner. And Kennedy was aware of that. Seems the rest of the Joint Chiefs weren't. So the threat of a coup was never from General Taylor, nor would he have stood still if one had taken place by Lyndon Johnson or anyone else. Nor would Ted Sorensen, CI Director John McCone, also handpicked by JFK, by the way, after the Bay of Pigs, got rid of Alan Dulles. JFK, and we talk about that too, Alan Dulles, and how Kennedy didn't trust the CIA and was very, very nervous about the CIA. Very nervous. And there's some implications if you read between the lines of what Ted's telling us in this text. JFK's brother Bobby, his brother Ted, Senator, or any of his aides. In a later chapter, I'll talk more about why a coup d'etat was not the reason for the assassination, nor the cover-up. Sorensen, yeah, handpicked by Kennedy, yes. Anyways, when the Joint Chiefs met with Kennedy, Curtis LeMay, General Curtis LeMay, folks, a man who believed in nuclear war because he thought even if we suffered hundreds or thousands or millions of deaths, the Russians would suffer even more. That's logic, isn't it? That's the same logic Iran uses against Israel. It wants Israel to attack them because so Iran could retaliate and wipe out Israel. And Ahmadinejad's quoted as saying that, yeah, we can take the hits because we have more people and more land. That's logical. Never mind what it does to the atmosphere and the rest of the world. So this was Curtis LeMay. To say he was a hawk is an understatement. So the Russians would suffer even more. So he, that was Curtis LeMay, and this is Sorensen talking. That's what he called his victory in war. And he lectured Kennedy on what he thought the quarantine, the combination of diplomacy and the blockade, was too weak a response and the American people wouldn't like it. Can you imagine a military chief lecturing the President of the United States on what the American people think? When Kennedy finally left that meeting and went out into the hall, he ran into me, and I know Kennedy was very upset. And he was upset, and he said to me, bear in mind, this is Friday the 19th, War, I mean, it was right in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He said to me, he pointed to the room and said, they're all getting things in worse shape, he said to me. You and Bobby have got to get this thing finished soon. But it turned out that he left his tape recorder going when he left the room, and we have recorded for history a book called The White House Tapes, The Inside Story of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And what LeMay and the Marine commander, David Shoup, and some others had to say behind Kennedy's back with Kennedy out of the room. Now, what he doesn't tell you, and I suspect, is that Kennedy purposely, Kennedy was very meticulous. He was a very smart man. I don't think he forgot to turn off the tape recorder at all. And I think he left it on purpose and left the room on purpose so he could find out what they were planning, if they were planning a coup d'etat or not. And for the answer for that, it's in the book, JFK Assassination from the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza. Let me go to the back of the book because this book is written for the next generation, and there are some things that are floating around, some myths, if you will, and I just want to debunk a couple of them right away because they've been proven over time to be false. And the big one right now that's it's not really anybody's fault. It's YouTube's fault, if you will. The Zapruder film is that most famous film that people have seen of the Kennedy assassination. Oliver Stone's movie Back and to the Left, Back and to the Left, the character Jim Garrison says is the very famous Zapruder film. Now, there have been uploads after uploads after uploads of the Zapruder film, all with crappy, lousy resolution, like 360, or worse, sometimes 240. So you can't tell really what's going on. There's no detail. I have a detailed digital copy of it in high definition, 1080p. And on most of the videos now, the lower resolution videos are being replaced, but there are still a few out there on YouTube that appears to show the driver turning around, shooting President Kennedy. That's completely false. Absolutely, completely, completely false. So let me just read this. Let me clear up a misconception that has been making the rounds on the internet. There are those that claim the Zapruder film, the film of the Kennedy assassination that was used in the movie JFK, shows the driver, Secret Service agent Will Greer, turning around and shooting the president with a gun in his hand. In fact, it does not. The illusion is due to the low-quality reproduction of the film, the sun that day in shadows. Greer did turn around towards the president, apparently surprised and somewhat mystified when he heard the shots ring out. Greer did the exact opposite of his limited Secret Service training by bringing the president's limo almost to a stop. Now, some people say he stopped completely. Okay, that works for me too. Either way, he panicked and he hit the brake pedal and not the gas pedal that he was trained to pick. And that goes back to what Abraham Bolden told me about drunk Secret Service agents. Not that I've ever been drunk or hungover, folks, but for those of you that have had that experience and you've been up all night, as some of these guards had, not been to sleep, you're still drunk. You're hungover. And when it's warm out, and it was that day, and there's a humidity, you're dozy. You're not razor sharp. And if you are guarding the President of the United States, you have to be razor sharp and able to act right away. And it's very visible in a famous picture called the Altgens photo, where you see two of the Secret Service guards on the right-hand side of the Secret Service car looking back towards the upper regions of the Texas School Book Depository after hearing the first shot. That reaction is the reaction of a novice, not a professional, somebody who's not razor sharp and not thinking. They should have been on the ground running as fast as they could the second they heard that shot, not looking to see what it was. Anyways, I digress. Whether or not Secret Service agents were, sorry, were he or other Secret Service agents part of a conspiracy to assassinate the president? No, absolutely not. And I'll tell you why. Others claim he was slowing the limo to let the Secret Service agents who were standing on the dashboards of the Secret Service protect the follow-up car directly behind the president's limo to get on his car to surround the president and protect him. That's another reason why some people think he stopped the car, because when able to allow the Secret Service agents to run and catch up. Mr. Bolden told me, even though the Secret Service agents were drunk, that in no way did he suspect any of them at any point being part of any type of conspiracy to assassinate the president. So here we go. This is another one that I just want to debunk as well. And this is the limousine. This is a short one. This is the limousine bubble top. And I think it's important because a lot of people think that the limousine bubble top that wasn't not in place that day would have saved the president. My view is that it probably would have caused even more carnage. And I'll explain why. Let me read on. Old theories about the assassination believe that the Secret Service was somehow complicit in the assassination of JFK. One of the theories for evidence was the removal of the plexiglass bubble top roof that sat atop JFK's presidential limo, allowing any snipers an unobstructed, pristine target in the open car. The bubble top roof was only used on occasions when there was adverse weather conditions. In truth, it was rarely used. Kennedy hated it. Under the sun, it would act like an incubator, holding the sun-heated air in the car. Now everybody says, well, I'll turn on the air conditioner. 1963, guys. Maybe a dozen cars had air conditioning in those days. The president's was one of those, but it was woefully inadequate. I mean, imagine the air conditioning probably just coming out of the front, right? You've got this big, huge limo. So it was used solely to keep the president dry in the rain. Indeed, it had been a torrential downpour that morning in Dallas before the president arrived. So how and why the bubble top removed? Here's the true story. And I found this on the internet. Just Google Jim Lehrer, bubble top. A young news reporter by the name of Jim Lehrer, the same Jim Lehrer now has a profoundly respected PBS news show, was present that day at Dallas Love Field Airport, assigned to cover the arrival of Air Force One and the president's entourage. Jim is quoted as saying that he clearly saw that the bubble top was originally on the president's limo. It was on, it was in place, before the plane landed. So, Lear approached a Secret Service agent, and, you know, the car is in a big lineup of cars, and he asked casually if the bubble top roof on the president's limo was going to be on or off during the upcoming motorcade through downtown Dallas. This was strictly for photographs and, as I turn the page, television cameras covering the motorcade so they could adjust their camera's aperture accordingly. Absolutely, you know, not digital in those days, eh, folks? If you wanted to focus something, you had to do it by hand. It was none of this autofocus or anything. As a matter of fact, you had to change lenses manually as well. So you had to be set up for a close shot or a distant shot beforehand. A Secret Service agent who knew Jim cordially greeted him and quizzically said he simply wasn't sure. The agent radioed the downtown area where the motorcade would pass to see if there was rain. The response came back that no, indeed, everything was clear. The sun was out. The agent turned and ordered other Secret Service agents to remove the bubble top roof. It was as simple as that. No conspiracy. If it was still raining, the roof would have remained on. Now the sun was out and the temperature rising, it came off. As noted that the bubble top roof was not bulletproof and made only of plexiglass. However, this is my view, should it have remained on the car, it would have caused grief to the snipers targeting Kennedy. Now, you got to realize, regardless, Kennedy was a marked man. He was going to be shot at if the bubble top roof was on or if the bubble top roof was off. They were going to try and kill him in Dealey Plaza. Consequently, had the bubble top been in place, they would have shot at the car anyway, but absolutely with less accuracy because they've got to penetrate the bubble glass, right? Consequently, the bullets piercing the plexiglass would be misdirected, ricocheting everywhere. It would have been an absolute bloodbath inside that car. Probably would have seen Jackie Kennedy and Nellie Connolly shot to pieces, along with countless bystanders, because obviously there's going to be far more ricochets. Jim Lehrer goes on to say that around midnight at the Dallas police station, after the assassination, that same Secret Service agent came up to him in tears and said, oh Jim, if I only hadn't removed the bubble top. But in all honesty, folks, in so doing, he may have just saved Jackie's life by allowing the president to be more of an open shot, and a shot that would be not ricocheted or obstructed in any way. Sad thing to say, but from tragedy comes good. I don't know if that makes any sense either. The book is called JFK Assassination, From the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza, interviews with witnesses and specialists, including the last interview with Ted Sorensen, JFK's friend and speechwriter. I've also put in this book, folks, 7 smoking guns. From people I've talked with, from first-person witnesses, once again, I believe that there are 7 smoking guns that can't be defended by the mainstream press that proof positive that there was a conspiracy to cover up the Kennedy assassination. I'm just going to read one of them here. And by the way, the number one smoking gun is what Ted Sorensen said about the assassination and confirmation that it was indeed a conspiracy. All right. How much time? 6 minutes. I better jump to it right away. This is the number 2 reason, and a lot of you are probably unaware of this. I had just been talking about the Secret Service, the follow-up car, 10 feet behind the president's car. Inside that car, 2 of Kennedy's best aides, Dave Powers, Kenny O'Donnell. If you've ever seen the movie 13 Days, Kevin Costner plays Kenny O'Donnell. That's how close those two guys were to the president. They don't lie, folks. Here we go. Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers, JFK's personal friends and aides. 2 impeccable witnesses saw the shots come from the grassy knoll in front of JFK. This is important because the official Warren Commission government report concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, that indeed all shots originated from behind JFK, specifically from the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository. Both of these witnesses were seated in the Secret Service car directly behind JFK's limousine, not more than a few feet from the president. These witnesses were none other than 2 of JFK's top aides and closest friends, Dave Powers and Kenny O'Donnell. Dave Powers, folks, first met John Kennedy in 1946 when JFK was looking for help in running his first political campaign for Congress. Powers was immediately taken with Kennedy's sincerity in helping constituents. Kenny O'Donnell was introduced to JFK by his friend Bobby Kennedy in 1946, also to help with JFK's run for Congress. Both Powers and O'Donnell became personal advisors to Kennedy when JFK was elected president. They remained a close-knit unit, often called the Irish Mafia. Both men were close friends and advisors to JFK for 17 years of political battles to get JFK into office. Their loyalty and belief in JFK were unwavering. They would often accompany Kennedy when he traveled and were both on that trip to Dallas. Both men were seated in the Secret Service follow-up car, little more than 10 feet from JFK when he was assassinated. Accordingly, what they witnessed and testified about the assassination should be taken as gospel. Both men have stated that they clearly saw the shots coming from the front of President Kennedy on the right side, the grassy knoll. Let me repeat that. Both of these 2 close witnesses clearly state they saw the shots coming from the grassy knoll. There's a direct quote here, and I did with Lamar Waldron, and according to Lamar Waldron, we arranged for Tom Hartman to have a private sit down with Dave Powers. Tom went into the office and Powers pointed to a rocking chair, and so Tom sat down in that nice rocking chair with the presidential emblem. David Powers said, that's one of JFK's rocking chairs from the White House. Tom was actually there to interview Powers about Cuba and something else. Tom was asking questions about Cuba, so he was stunned when Powers started telling him about seeing the shots from what is called the grassy knoll. Tom was also stunned when Powers said he and O'Donnell were told they had to change their stories for the good of the country. Powers said he did not know what that meant at the time, but he made it clear to him that this was national security. And there's a couple of quotes here. And Powers says that same bullet that hit JFK did not hit John Connolly. And the Warren Commission was handed this theory on a platter, and anything that didn't conform with it, they didn't take. The book, folks, I've been reading from tonight is my very own, The JFK Assassination, from the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza. It's witnesses, first-person witnesses for a future generation in their own words. Because as anybody knows, when you do research, you've got to get as close to the original source as possible. These are the original sources. You've got the doctor who worked on JFK, James Teague, who was in Dealey Plaza. Somebody we didn't get to, we're going to get to in the second hour, the Babushka Lady, also known as Beverly Oliver. Ted Sorensen, that's what makes this book stand apart from all the others. You can get it at www.nightfrightshow.com, www.nightfrightshow.com. Check out all the JFK archives. All the top-notch researchers are there. Mark Lane, Jim DiEugenio, and on, and on, Jim Mars, on and on and on and on. All these fabulous people have given their time, because nobody gets paid on Night Fright, baby. They just do it because they care about getting the word out. You can get this book at www.nightfrightshow. I would advise you to get it. It's historical. You can pass it down. And it's a hard copy. Isn't that nice? It's a hard copy. So it's not, if your computer dies, this won't die with it. I'm Red Holland from Night Fright. See you next time.
JFK Assassination, the definitive book by Brent Holland. From inside the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza, first-person witness accounts. Order yours right now, nightfrightshow.com.